You're listening to a Stranger podcast, www.thestranger.com.
Hi, you're listening to Invisible, the Stranger's weekly conversation with people in art. Today I'm at Western Bridge with Anthony McCall. Hi.
Hello.
And he's got a piece here called Doubling Back that dates from 2003, but was last seen at the Whitney Biennial in 2004. Mm-hmm. We are going to talk about not only that piece, but also earlier work. This is a continuation of the Solid Light series of work that began in 1973 with the piece Line...
Describing a Cone.
Describing a Cone. Mm. Thank you. I always forget the word describing.
Yes.
Line Describing a Cone. And that piece, you know, is the way that we can talk about these for those people who haven't seen them. It's a little difficult, but they are described, and you've described them too, as a cross between sculpture and cinema. Line Describing a Cone is a single dot that then expands into a full circle. A full circle, Line Describing a Circle.
Yes.
That then brings to life a
volumetric
cone in
the room. Form. Mm-hmm. Yes, I mean the circle as the line on the wall describes a circle in three-dimensional space. You have a conical, volumetric conical form coming into being. Mm. You can see that because of the haze in the room, which makes the light palpable and visible.
The haze is something Eric Fredrickson, who's director here at Western Bridge, was mentioning to me, that you were making these pieces at first in lofts in New York, and you didn't need to produce haze.
No, lofts really were ex-industrial spaces.
Right.
They did not have polished floors, and they didn't have nice, clean sheetrock walls. They were full of dust and grit, and when you had a few people in them, you without even realizing it, you'd stirred up quite a bit of dust in the air. And those particles in the air were just about sufficient to see the forms. Coupled with the fact that always three or four people were smoking, because they just did. And I never thought that I had to create any special conditions for the showing of these films until I began to show them in museums.
So you moved uptown.
The move uptown rendered the films completely and utterly invisible.
Mm-hmm.
And it was something of a crisis, actually. Because you simply weren't allowed to smoke, and there were no real easy ways to create some kind of thickening of the air.
Mm-hmm. The pieces were at the time drawings that you then animated into films.
Yes.
And at this point are now digital images that are projected as time sequences.
Yes. The old work was made. I would begin with a line drawing, literally a white line drawn with gouache and a ruling pen on black paper, just then put under an animation camera and shot frame by frame, which is the way you did conventional animation at that time. Very simple animation, very laborious, but you know, step by step. And the new work is made using a computer, and essentially is a computer script, which is written, which is a combination of verbal instructions and arithmetic, math. And the computer is reading the script as you're watching. The computer is generating the forms in real time from the script.
For the people who haven't seen this piece yet, it opens tonight at Western Bridge. Actually Thursday, September
19th, yes, I think that's right.
So by the time this runs, who knows when. It may already be open. It is an experience that's quite unlike any other, but it also brings up about, you know, tons and tons of kind of tangential feelings. You have the sense that this relates to that, and it relates to that, and relates to that, and yet that it's something completely new in terms of experience. Essentially, I it's very difficult to describe, but I would say that one way to describe it is you're standing inside of forms that don't exist. But you would never be able to be convinced of that. You're essentially standing inside of air forms. Mm. And the way that the mister works is it, the mister is, comes on and then goes off, comes on and then goes off. And what that does is it changes the skin of the shapes.
Right.
So that at times they're moving with this kind of haze, and at other times they sort of flatten into this almost perfect marble white. Mm. So, and the shapes seem to change their character when the skin changes.
Yes. Yes.
And also the lines that are projected on the wall, which you refer to as footprints,
yep.
And the light bodies coming off of them are the bodies
yeah.
that associate with these footprints.
Mm-hmm.
I hope I'm making some sense.
You are.
but we've seen it.
Yes.
You know, this light body changes when the drawings move.
Yeah.
So also, it's not only changing its surface, it's also changing in volume continuously.
Mm-hmm.
And when... in or I don't know whether this will help, but in order to give some kind of sense of it, it's in a darkened room, completely darkened room, and when a person is standing inside one of the forms or in between the forms in one of the gaps, and a person walks out of the form, they absolutely vanish.
Right. And when you're inside the form, you can't see out.
Mm-hmm.
The silver membranes, if you like, are almost opaque.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's a very big difference when you pass from being inside to outside. It's a very big change. And you are, like any sculptural form, you can look at it from the outside and watch it changing. But unlike most sculptural forms, you can go inside and be incorporated into it. It's as if there's, it's a absolute, it has an absolute outline, the form, and yet it, there is nothing. There is nothing there. The skin is invisible. I mean, it's not invisible at all.
It's visible.
It's visible, but it's not... you think that it's tactile. You go to touch it, but you can't find it.
You want to touch it.
You test it.
Yeah.
You test it.
Yeah.
And I call this kind of form a durational structure. By that I mean it is a sculptural form, but it is also a cinematic one. And it's sculptural in the sense that it's volumetric and three-dimensional, but it's also undergoing, it's in a state of continuous alteration and change, mutation if you like, but very, very slowly. So the durational structure is quite stable. And as I would put it, you know, you as the spectator are the fastest object in the room.
Mm-hmm.
The form itself is moving slowly on its own time. And you can't really quite catch it changing, but every 5 or 10 minutes you realize it's completely transformed itself.
Mm-hmm. There are two things I wanted to talk about. One is having to do with what you were just talking about, the spectator being central. One of the things that is surprising for a spectator when you first enter one of these forms is that standing closest to the footprint, in other words, farthest from the projector and closest to the wall, you are surprised at the fact that you don't interrupt the shape.
Mm.
The volume keeps its shape because of the way the drawings work and because of your desire to fit into the shapes.
Yeah.
You know, you. So that's something that is quite surprising when you're in it. Another thing is that we should mention that it is called Doubling Back for a reason. It is a 30-minute entire sequence, but 15 minutes it moves in a certain way, and then it stops. There's a gap.
Mm.
Is this correct? After 15 minutes?
It simply stops.
It simply stops after 15, but not after 30, right?
Right. Well,
15 and 30 and 15 and 30.
Right.
Right.
So after 30, there is a gap.
Okay.
But in the middle of the sequence, 15 minutes in, it just stops
just
and
stops.
Then reverses direction.
I see. Okay. So the darkness comes only at 30.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, so you start to believe that you are getting some purchase on which shapes to expect by expecting them to be the same shapes in reverse from the shapes
right.
you saw during the first 15 minutes. I want to go back to the beginning of this idea and also where it comes from. Mm. And those people who want to know a little bit more about this can go to a 2005 book by Northwestern Press called Anthony McCall, The Solid Light Films and Related Works, which is edited by Christopher Eamon. But we're going to talk a little bit about that stuff. What I'd like to know is, where were you for all of those years? What happened when you stopped, and what happened when you started? Essentially, you stopped making art for 2 decades.
Yeah.
And then sort of reappeared around 2003.
Yes, that's right. I was making... I left art school in 1968. I began making art in around 1972. I made it until about 1980, so 8-9 years. And then I stopped for 20 years, and then I resumed again in, around 2000, making my first new work. This one, actually, in 2003. This was the first new work for 25 years. I now refer to this 20 years, the missing years, as the big sleep. I was actually in plain sight, right at the center of things, designing and editing art publications, which I withdrew from in 2000. But in truth, stopping completely making something for 20 years is certainly a... some kind of pathological sickness which belongs in the realm of the shrink. But suffice to say, there were some good practical reasons. One of them was simply that in those years, you couldn't really make a living from this kind of work. Mm-hmm. It was shown in documenters and biennials and so on. And some galleries, particularly in Europe, galleries that showed conceptual art or minimalism or something like that would get the point of these films and show them. Mm. But they'd show them for one evening as a special event. Mm. And in the morning they would go back to doing what they did, which is selling objects on the floor or on the wall. Mm. And so there was that impossibility. So I was in my early 30s and I was getting quite worried about how the hell I would pay the rent. And I began to do graphic design, which I'd been trained to do, actually. I mean, I'm self-taught as an artist. Mm. And so that gradually... It's not that I made a decision to stop, it just sort of took me over, as things do. But there was another actually quite serious problem, because I did consider returning at various times. But this visibility issue seemed to me to be insurmountable. Mm-hmm. The fact that I could make new work, but if it was invisible, what was the point? I mean, it seemed a completely sort of futile thing. And that contingency, that problem of how you would make the thing visible, seemed so overwhelming that I could never quite get around it. Mm. And
visible, you mean seen, part
seen.
Of the system.
Yes, mm-hmm. Because without that dust, without the cigarette smoke, or whatever it was, you couldn't see them.
I see.
And then somewhere in the 90s, perhaps earlier, but fog machines came onto the horizon. I think they probably were invented around the time discotheques came into being, and you know, theatrical and film production technologies were improving and changing. But they really came. I think they were around in full force by the mid 90s, and I began to realize they existed. And that realization was a backdrop to my decision to return. But of course, it wasn't enough. But mm-hmm. it certainly was. It enabled me to consider making work again. And there were other completely personal reasons why I did. But in any case, I knew at that moment that I really could return and reconsider this whole form.
Mm. When you started making work, when did you come to New York?
I came to New York from London in the beginning of 1973.
Okay. Can you talk about where this work came from? Can you talk about the fire performances?
Mm, I can. Perfect. Yes, I can. when I started making art, I began really doing performances. Some were performances for the camera, and they ended up as a set of still photographs. And some were live performances in landscape. In particular, the biggest series I did was called Landscape for Fire, which then changed to Fire Cycles. And those were performances in landscape using grids of small fires, controlled fires that were gasoline fires that were carefully measured and lit and relit, so that the grid, the square grid, would create changing configurations of fires. So these, in a way, were my first durational structures. Mm-hmm. But aware that these were existed once in an obscure location, I realized that it would be quite useful to do something more than just take photographs. And that's when I decided I would learn how to make films. Mm-hmm. And almost my first film was a film called Landscape for Fire, which was a record of one of these fire performances. I finished the film. I learned to edit. I cut sound, all the rest of it. And I became completely engrossed with the medium and got so really interested in what its possibilities were. But now I had a finished film, and I would show this in downtown spaces, in galleries and so on, museums. No, not museums, actually, but the sort of alternative equivalent. And I became aware that there was a sort of paradox in showing this as my work when the real work had been the performance, not the mm-hmm. projection of the performance. And I began to think... I had also become interested in the work of avant-garde filmmakers. I was well aware of the London Filmmakers Co-op and the discourse around that, which had to do with the attempt to find a materialist basis for cinema, mm-hmm. rather than one based on literary narrative. Mm-hmm. And all these things were sort of floating around as the air I was breathing, if you like. And I began to ask the question of my own film, well... So there's a problem with it being a secondary document. Well, what would a film look like if it were a primary one? What would it be like if the film only existed at the moment of projection, mm-hmm. in the same present tense as that of the spectator? And my answer to that particular question was the line describing a cone, which was the first of this series, mm-hmm. which is the coming into being of a cone of light in the same time as that of those watching it. And it refers to no past time, no, there's no past, there's only that present moment. And so that was the beginning of this series, in a way, growing out of performance.
This current piece, can you tell me, actually, in Line Describing a Cone, I haven't seen that piece, only read about it, what happens after the cone becomes?
A full cone?
Yeah.
It vanishes.
Okay.
In a way, Line Describing a Cone is quite unlike all the subsequent ones, in that it is, in a sense, a narrative. If by narrative you mean it has a logic which begins and it comes to fruition and then ends, it is a narrative film.
Right.
And it was also made to show to an assembled audience.
Mm.
Now, it isn't shown that way so much now. It's shown as an installation. And... as a matter of fact, it was shown first as an installation quite recently at the Whitney exhibition, Chrissy Isles' exhibition, Into the Light, which was an attempt to create a prehistory for a lot of the current video by looking at the moving image work done by artists from the mid-60s to the mid-70s.
Mm-hmm.
And we had long discussions about how to show it. Here we had a museum context, in which people are coming and going all day long.
Mm-hmm.
If you show it at 8 p.m. or at 3 p.m., you'll show it to a few people, but people don't use museums in that way. And so the question was, do we show it occasionally at certain times, or do we show it continuously as an installation? And I had to think very hard about that. I was quite resistant to this film being an installation, although in the 70s I was making pieces that were specifically and deliberately extended installations, because I was testing what happened when you tried to break up the assembled audience into individual people. But I did eventually decide it was worth trying, and we did it. And in fact, now I consider there are two ways to show line discovery in Cone, to an assembled audience or in installation. Mm-hmm. They both have their virtues, they both have the major differences between them. But I don't consider one now better or worse than the other, merely different.
And this piece, Doubling Back, is certainly not... It does have its own relationship to time. Certainly, it's not unrelated to time. It's not in some kind of nebulous time space, but... And it's the same length as Line Describing a Cone, 30 minutes. Mm. But by the way, where is Line Describing a Cone? Is it at the Whitney?
It's an addition, so it's in many places.
Oh, it is?
Yes,
okay.
It's in a number of collections. It's the Whitney has one, Baltimore Museum of Art, mm-hmm. and then various museums in England and Europe.
How many editions?
It's the only unlimited edition.
Really?
All the other pieces I've made are editions of five, usually. Huh. But that one, because I'd already started, that was the only one that was collected, really. I mean, that was the only piece of mine I'd ever sold. So when I started again, it was easy to go back to all the other ones and just say, we'll make them an edition of five.
Yeah.
And leave that one as it was. And it's been fine. I mean... you know, the issue of editioning is a controversial one. It's tricky. You're setting in a sense an artificial limit.
Yeah.
But I've come to see it as being a very practical thing to do. For one thing, the people who collect it know there's only a few of them, and it's a question of conservation. You know, you do take responsibility if you know you're one of only a few.
Yeah.
Whereas otherwise it's like a piece of ephemera in a way.
Mm-hmm.
I mean from a conservation point of view, I think it's a practical thing, because in the future it's the collections who are going to have to take the responsibility for upgrading anything technologically.
Yeah.
The artists will be dead, the institutions go on. And I thought about this a lot, and I think it's important that the collectors know who they are, they can compare notes, help one another.
Mm-hmm.
Upgrades are possible.
Yeah.
But, you know, as it is with if there are thousands of things, people, no one really needs to take responsibility, because there must be others.
Right.
And the other thing is, it's also a reflection of a practical reflection of the fact that there are relatively small numbers of people interested in and able to collect.
Yeah.
And inasmuch as we're not in a country here that has public institutions, all the cultural institutions are private on the whole.
Yeah.
It's I've made my peace with the structure. I know when I was my work in the 70s was thought of as being part of the avant-garde film tradition,
mm-hmm.
and really avant-garde film has no economic model,
mm-hmm.
other than perhaps teaching. Mm-hmm. I mean, it draws on the same model that Hollywood uses, which is the filmmaker gets a cut of the box office, which is essentially what happens in Hollywood. Unfortunately, if you have three screenings a year and each the take at the box office is $200 for each, and you get half of that, that gives you an annual income of $300, which is not an economy. And these issues are, they're certainly, since I know very well what it was like, and one of the reasons I stopped was economic one, they're not trivial issues.
Yeah, not at all. The Trues bought an edition of Doubling Back, so that is here to stay in Seattle.
Yeah, yeah.
And that work, we were talking a little bit when we were down in the gallery experiencing it about James Turrell. And the differences there. I think what brought it to mind is probably something I said about sort of the point of light, where if you're standing and facing the projection, you'll see this white point of light, and then the shapes all sort of emanate from that point.
Yes.
And the sense of sublimity came up.
Right.
And you said there's quite a difference between you and James Turrell.
Yes, that's right, I did. It's like James Turrell lives in a volcano and I live in a loft in New York.
Yeah.
And, I think in truth, you know, light carries with it all kinds of associations. I think my impression is that he's directly interested in those associations, mm-hmm. and I think, in a way, wants to instill them in his spectators. That's my impression. I could be quite wrong. I don't want to put words in his mouth, but that's my. But looking at his titles and the way, and what it feels like when you enter the room, there's a kind of chapel-like stillness mm-hmm. in his work, in some of it. My feeling is that some of those associations are certainly present in my work. People who watch the pieces sometimes talk about them and ask me about it, as you are. And my feeling is that this is something I'm still a materialist. I like to work from my material. I like to set myself formal problems, which have to do with space and duration and architecture and various things like that. I am now very interested in, for instance, the body as something you could represent. But I feel that the feelings that members of the spectators feel or get, that's part of their work and their experience, and it's not something I can control. It's not possible for me, even if I wanted to say I'd like this to have a more sublime feeling than the one I made last year. It's just not something. It's not something one can work with. Mm-hmm. And so I more or less pretend it doesn't exist, and I focus on very, very material, very things that I can think about.
Speaking of that, we were talking about how Richard Serra used to come to your events in the 70s.
Yeah.
And he might, oddly enough, be an artist worth thinking about in the context of this work, because there's something to the surfaces of the volumes that Doubling Back creates. Mm. They're soft. They they're soft in a tactile way. I mean, you do want to touch them, but they're also extraordinarily strong. There's nothing you can do to make those disappear.
Yeah.
And there's a similarity to Corten Steel, where, especially at the beginning of Corten Steel, you can really, the skin of it is absolutely feltish. Mm-hmm. And there's this doubleness to that, that material. Mm. Eric Fredrickson and I were just talking about this morning, where people have been writing their names in things at the sculpture park in Seattle.
Right.
And while it's a disturbing thing, I think what's most disturbing about that kind of graffiti is the seeming betrayal of the strength of the object. And so there's something to that sort of skin quality that's similar in what you've.
I think that's a very fair comment. I mean, there are some real points of correspondence, but there are also major differences. I mean, one of them is, you know, with Sarah's work, especially the last few years, you have this obdurate physicality, this absolute solidity. It's so much about mass and gravity and strength and weight and so on. And whereas my work is, by contrast, is not even in the physical world.
Weighs nothing.
And I think of it as, my work is, in a way, information. Mm-hmm. And his is an object. You know, it's a very interesting thing to tease out, really. I mean, I think about this quite a bit, and
I don't want to interrupt, but I just wanted to say, you said information, and that made me think of the walls of these structures. I mean, I hate to talk about them in such physical terms, but there's no other way to discuss this.
Right.
These walls made of light are also striated. And the reason for that is that, as you described to me, the pixelation of the image, the digital image that's being projected, and that by contrast with the 70s work where you used to draw the line.
Yes.
What went into your decision to draw the line, not draw the line, make a digital leap?
What was the obvious thing to do, really? I mean, it was actually, it's very hard to find an animation camera in New York anymore. I found one, and I worked with, in fact, when I made Doubling Back originally, I did make it, I began making it the old-fashioned way. Huh. But I then discovered that my since I'd, of course, by then been working for 10 years with a computer, you know, I discovered that the things I wanted to do were very difficult to do the old-fashioned way because the calculations were too complex. Hmm. You know, the transition of curves through time, for instance, is very, very hard to plot and to get right. And it was just easier to make them in a computer, which is a good reason to use one. together with just the difficulty of making making work with film and animation cameras at a time when the medium is getting harder and harder to use. Mm-hmm. The labs are having fewer and fewer baths to develop them, and it's just getting more difficult. But just to go back very briefly to Sarah again, I think there's one very interesting point of similarity, which I feel with his torqued ellipses, with his spirals, all those forms, which is that I think they're very cinematic. With my work, the cinematic progression is achieved within the program, if you like, within the durational structure. He has a similar thing, though, in that he is also working with disclosure, but the disclosure is controlled by the spectator walking through the piece. You leave something behind, which you remember, you anticipate where you're going, and you come around the corner, and you eventually arrive somewhere. And in fact, with some of those pieces, you do arrive at a centre and have to double back.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I think those things are points of correspondence. Which, but the differences are so profound that it's also, you know, so it was a good comparison.
What are you working on now? I mean, let's talk about what you're working on now.
I'm working on
Something at the Highline?
That's a proposal which is possible, which may possibly be done in the Highline in New York. Mm-hmm. But it's not a competition. But there are, you know, it'll be one of four proposals will be selected. But I mean, the new films I'm making now are all in the last 2 years have all been about this possibility of representing the body. Not in a pictorial sense, but in the sense that bodies have rhythms, they have cycles, and they and the interesting thing to me about a body is that it is always seen. We experience our own bodies always in relation to others, and so the new work is all about attempting to map or to model or to make pieces out of that idea of the exchange between two forms, between two bodies. Mm. And so all the pieces I've made in the last few years have titles like Breath, Exchange, You and I, Between You and I Horizontal, and the one I'm working on right now is called Leaving, and this film will be the first time that I will have used sound since making Landscape for Fire. So I've come full circle a little bit, and I'm working with sound and image at the moment for the first time.
Those sound amazing. I'd love to see
Thank
them.
You.
Where have they recently been seen?
Well, I had an exhibition at Sean Kelly Gallery in New York where I showed a two-projector piece called You and I Horizontal 3, a third in the series. It's still on, actually, in France, the Musée de Rochechouart, which is near Limoges. There's a small retrospective of my work with groups of work from the 70s and from the last few years. So it's an attempt to compare the two periods, actually.
Yeah.
And that show is going to go to the Serpentine Gallery in London, which will open mid-December and run through early February, I think.
Good. Okay. Thank you so much for taking the time.
My pleasure.
Fun.